The next topic affects most, if not all, lawyers, except for those in corporate positions, and that's on billing issues. How do you deal with billing disputes? I guess the lawyers have to go to Bezin too. Question of double billing, when you travel someplace and you're representing two clients and you're waiting in court for two clients, can you charge, do you have to allocate it, can you charge them both? I always had a question, how law firms, if somebody calls a lawyer and asks them a question and they do research, 5 hours of research, they bill them for 5 hours of research, the next day another client calls with the same question, do they just give them the free advice because somebody else paid for the research? Do they charge them again for the research that they conducted for the other client? What's the halachic ramifications?
You just ask the question,
you'll
get out of it.
Right. And generally, does Einar, the fact of cheating, I guess, does it apply to professional services? And that presentation will be given by Rabbi...
Only charging, not cheating.
Sorry?
Only charging, not cheating.
Right. There's no such thing as overcharging. The Rabbi Ari Marburger is going to give the presentation. Rabbi Ari Marburger... You probably all know that he's the Dayan of Business Halacha Institute. He's author of a book called Business Halacha, but very few of you know that he's the force behind all these symposiums. If not for Rabbi Marburger, we wouldn't be here this morning. So without any further ado...
Thank you, Chanoch. It's never in good taste to take issue with the moderator. But just one correction, the driving force behind this morning's event is really Chanoch. He did all the heavy lifting, and really a special round of applause for all his efforts. Because of my involvement in arranging this event, after the topics were chosen, everyone, all the speakers got to pick what they wanted to address. And perhaps unsurprisingly, talking to attorneys about billing issues was not taken. It is, as you can imagine, a difficult topic and perhaps not one which makes many friends talking about it. But my one point of hisnatzlus is that to a certain degree, I really share many of the same challenges that you confront. As a dayan, we also very frequently will bill by the hour. And very frequently we'll have many of the same ethical challenges and issues do come up. The only difference between us is a couple of zeros, but at least the concepts or these struggles are something that really many we have in common. Now let's begin with focusing on some of the nuts and bolts and some of the actual halacha. We all know the importance of getting a clear engagement letter, which spells out the pricing, spells out the terms of the engagement. If you need another reason to have it clear, halacha and Shin Lamed Beis. What is halacha if a client retains you, they hire you to represent them, you do the work, and there's no discussion about what your fees are going to be? At the end of the litigation, or at the end of the month, you present them a bill. What is the halacha? And the client is shocked. He was not expected to pay this much. What is the halacha? When you hire someone without negotiating exactly what he's going to be paid. So if you hear the halacha is, it's in halacha, it's brought down in Siman Shin Lamed Beis. If you hire a worker, and you don't discuss the price, at the end of the term, when it comes to get paid, the halacha is the worker is only entitled to pachos shebapayla. He's entitled to the minimum wage, and it doesn't mean minimum wage, a statutory minimum wage. What it means is whatever this job is, you hire a painter, he does your house, he presents you with a bill. If you didn't negotiate the price beforehand, you go out, you look what other painters charge, and you get paid pachos shebapayla. Even if there's a range, some get paid, some charge more, some charge less. If you don't speak anything out in advance, the assumption is that everyone wants a good deal. And the burden of stipulating, the burden of asking for more is on the worker. If he fails to do so, at the end, he's entitled to only the absolute minimum, the absolute pachos shebapayla. Now, to put that in perspective, you have it, even if someone hires an attorney, and at the end, and they do not discuss what the hourly rate is, the attorney then bills him for his whatever he typically charges. So for argument's sake, he's billing at $350 an hour. The client comes back and says, listen, there was no engagement letter. We didn't discuss in advance. I'm paying you package of poilum. Now, we all know, if you look, you'll always find an attorney that's available for cheap. You'll find someone who's being paid, you know, $100 an hour, whatever it may be. So as a matter of halacha, it would seem that if you don't negotiate in advance, that is all that you're entitled to. Now, you do have to make a little bit of a distinction. That pachas ha'poilum is, you hire a painter, and there's no agreement, the painter is only entitled to the minimal amount that painters charge. On the other hand, you hire a doctor to work for you, that rate is going to be different. In attorneys as well, arguably, you can differentiate or between different classes. You hire a securities attorney in Manhattan, then and when you get your bill, the person complains, no, I want to pay you bakash of a pilot. As a comparison, he could not come ahead and say that I got a ticket when I was on my way to the country, and the attorney that I hired in the country to fight my ticket was $100 an hour. Because although they may both be attorneys, but that's not bakash of a pilot for a securities litigation in Manhattan. For Pachas ha'poilum, you have to compare apples and apples and oranges to oranges. So if you whatever your particular field is, wherever your area of practice is, if there is no negotiation in advance, you'll get paid Pachas ha'poilum, you'll get the minimal amount, but it's a minimal amount for this type of service, this type of litigation in this area. So while the client will not be able to force you to take that minimal amount that the country lawyer is getting paid, nevertheless, certainly is a very good idea to have very clear negotiations in advance if you're expecting to get paid your full fee. Now, there is room to say that perhaps the halacha today is different. If you have professionals today very often have set prices. And everyone knows that every professional has a rate that they bill their clients on. So one could argue that if a client comes in, knows you have a set fee, and retains you without even bothering to ask, perhaps he is implicitly accepting whatever your normal rate is. And that's an argument that is a reasonable argument and probably would prevail. However, you have to be careful. Because this argument only holds true if you have your set rate that you charge everyone. So in that case, you can take the position that you hired me, you know I have a rate, you know that I have a standard, you don't bother asking, you're accepting whatever that is. On the other hand, if the rate is negotiable, you may start off at the same rate, but depending on the client, depending on the situations, you're flexible. And you will drop down. You yourself have a range of billing rates that you've accepted, that you will accept with different clients, then certainly if someone retains you and there's no discussions, you're not going to be able to charge anything more than your base, than your minimal rate, because that is the pachash of a pilot for you. If you're willing to work for this rate for some people, then if you want more from this person, if you want your top rate, you certainly would have to negotiate in advance, and therefore, again, it's extremely important before you begin a job to make sure that there's a clear letter of engagement, that your rate is clear and accepted by the client. So this is as far as negotiating how much, what the rate should be, or what happens if there's no specific negotiations. What are the halachos, if any, about setting prices? What is considered a fair price for your services, and does it matter? Do you have an obligation to make sure that your prices are fair, or can you just ask for whatever you want? So this brings us to the concept of oino. Oino, whether it's overcharging or ripping someone off, oino is simply stated is that in halacha, when you sell something, and that's the typical case that's discussed, if you're selling goods, there's an obligation to make sure the price is fair. Fair doesn't mean what a dayan thinks is right. Fair just means consistent with market value. You have a car, its market value is $10,000. Someone walks into your dealership, doesn't know anything about cars, and you know you can sell it to him for $15,000, that's oino. You're charging him more than the market value. It's important to note, oino has nothing to do with lying. You don't tell him this is the going rate. You don't fool him into thinking that everyone's paying that. You simply tell him that you want the car, this is what you're going to have to pay. If he accepts that, because you're taking advantage of his lack of knowledge, you're charging him more than the fair market value without him knowing it, that is the Isser of Aina. Now, Aina has a number of exceptions. The most known is the exception of karka, real estate. When you're selling real property, there the gedorim of Aina do not apply. You do not have a tzvias mamon. You're selling, anyone who knows anything about real estate, prices fluctuate widely. People will pay a premium for real estate, or for that matter, if they're desperate, they'll sell it cheap. And the concept of Aina does not apply. According to some, you still shouldn't overcharge someone, but at least the halacha, it's the recourse, certainly does not exist. Now, a second exception is when you're buying and selling slaves. Slaves in halacha are comparable to real estate, and the same way real estate is not subject to Aina, then when you're buying and selling a slave, there is no Aina either. Now, you're probably wondering why we're talking about slaves. The answer is that there is although the discussion in the Gemara focuses on buying and selling, what is halacha if you hire an employee? You hire someone to do a job. Is there Aina or not? So if you hear the halacha is, and the way the Rambam seems to understand, is that a payo, someone who's hired to do a job for you, is not subject to Hilchos Aina. And the reason for that is that a payo, someone who is working for you, is to a certain degree similar to a slave. You've paid him for his time, he's working for you. And to the extent that you're paying him to, and he's working for you, the same way karka, real estate, slave do not have Aina, a payo as well will not be subject to the halachos of Aina. Now this sounds like wonderful news, because what that means is you can set whatever your price may be, regardless of whether you're really worth that or not, there would be no recourse of Aina, according to some the Yisra would apply, but there would be no recourse. Now, before anyone gets too excited, there is a bit of a debate, but Shulchan Aruch paskens that it really depends on the kind of worker. A payo is a salaried employee. He works for you 9 to 5, he gets paid by the hour, he's your employee. An employee has similarities to a slave, and therefore the same way a slave is not subject to Aina, an employee is exempted as well. A koblen, roughly an independent contractor, is different. Because when you hire a contractor, you tell him, ask him to perform a task for you, he's not your slave. He's going to do the job on his own schedule, when he wants to do it, as he pleases. He's a contractor, so he's providing a service for you, but he's not your direct employee. You're not buying his time. And therefore, halacha, we hold, this is not a contractor is not compared to an eved, to a slave, and therefore they would be subject to the rules of Aina. Now what will come out then is really a fascinating difference. If you are an in-house counsel for someone, in-house counsel, you are on a salary, you work 9 to 5, halavai 9 to 5, but whatever, you're on a salary, your time is owned by your employer. So there would be a no Aina, which means regardless of whether you are really worth your salary, even if you're getting paid more than your true value, there would be no claim of Aina. And unfortunately, the converse is true as well. If you were being underpaid for your services, you would not be able to haul your boss in front of a bezdin and say you've been ripping me off, you've been underpaying me, because as a payo, similar to an eved, the recourse of Aina would not apply. On the other hand, that's by a payo. That's a salaried employee. If you are a koblen, if you are a contractor, you're hired to take care of a closing. You do the work at your own schedule when you please, and very often you're going to get paid a flat amount to a set fee to do the closing. That clearly is a koblen. You're not his payo, you're not his slave, you work on your own schedule. Obviously you'll have to accommodate the closing and everyone else's schedules. But in that case, you're a koblen, and there you would be subject to the rules of Aina. And therefore what you're billing would have to be consistent with the market value. You have a client that simply doesn't know what the going rate is, and you take advantage of that, you quote them a price, even though they've accepted the price, they've signed the retaining letter, they're willing to pay it. Nevertheless, by charging them more than the fair market value of your services, that would be an Isser Aina, and they would have the right to come to Bezdin afterwards and say, we want a refund. even though they accepted it, they agreed to it, they paid it, there was no fraud, they came to you, you just quoted them a price, they accepted it. Nevertheless, Hilchos Neinah says you can't take advantage of other people's lack of knowledge, and you can't charge them more than the fair market value for your services. Now, as a matter of practice, I have never heard of an attorney being hauled in front of a Beis Din and being with a claim of Aina. There are a number of reasons for that, but perhaps the simplest is market value is something which is extremely difficult to determine. There is a wide range of prices that attorneys charge. It'll be based on their skill, it'll be based on their experience, they're based on a number of factors. And if you try to prove that the rate that's being billed is simply inappropriate and above market value, you really have to be able to prove that an attorney with this level of experience, this level of expertise, should be charging less. So to prove that is going to be difficult. The client also has to come right away. But conceptually, as far as what you're allowed to do, you have to realize charging more than the market rate for your services is awesome. And even though the client accepted the price, unless you clearly disclose normal billing rates for my kind of lawyer is $300 an hour, I'm charging $400, which is not going to be very good for business, that kind of disclosure. But in the absence of doing that, charging more than your value for a cobbler is going to be awesome.
If you're charging the same amount for all your clients, does that in effect set a market value for your particular services?
No, it means you're ripping off all of your clients, not just some of them. Now, if you have some unique experience or some unique talent that no one else has, then by definition, there won't be a no because you define your own value. But on the other hand, if you're a lawyer, like every other lawyer with your level of experience, everyone else charges X, you're charging above that, that is a problem of a no. Okay, wait, so you're going back to you're not talking about Aino. In Hilchos Aino, when we're talking about market value, if there is a statutory rate, that will define market value.
Well, it's an upper limit.
What?
It's an upper limit. So in a Med Mal case, it tells you what the upper limit is.
Fine, but in Hilchos Aino, when we talk about market value, we're talking about what the normal going rate is. The fact that one person will be below that, no one has an obligation to follow that because that's not market value. Market value is what most people are what typical people charge. And therefore, the outliers will not define Aino. Aino is... Oh, you're going back to the first discussion. Okay, Pachas of Apoyolim would mean the lower amount. I think if you'd find one person out of a million, you'd probably argue Batal Daite. It has to be a price that can be found, that's achievable. The fact that one person under one circumstance bought the business is not going to define a rate. But if there's a range, there are people who charge more, people who charge less. If you don't stipulate in advance, you're going to be stuck with the less.
The pasuk talks about in household. In New York, at least, so for example, you retain the files until the dispute is dealt with or the payment is made, or you have an obligation to already give over the document or the file or whatever before that.
Okay, in a general sense, if an employee or a worker produces work and is not paid, he has the right to say, and in fact there's an expectation almost, that a cobbler that produces work does not give over the material until he gets paid, to the extent that if you work on something, you are considered a shomer sachar. As long as you're holding on to it, you have a special liability to safeguard it, because we look at it as if you're getting paid to hold on to it. What's your pay? Your pay is you're going to use this as leverage to make sure that your bill is paid at the end.
And that's even if it causes a loss.
Okay, again, in specific cases and how far to go, we'll have to deal with it. But at least the general concept that if you produce something, you're not paid for that work, you don't have to give over the fruits of your labor and go chase him afterwards. That's the general concept. Whether it'll apply to every case or not, you'll have to deal with it as it comes up. So again, the concept of Aino is, if you know what your, as far as enforceability, is virtually impossible to win a case in Beis Din, but as far as when you're setting your rates, you have to give a little thought, are my rates, do they really reflect the market value for my services? If not, you are very, very likely will be over the Isser of Aino. Now, another common billing dispute that comes up is you're retained to work on a specific issue. You are clever enough to clearly discuss what your hourly billing rate is. Comes the end of the month, or the end, or when the litigation is over, you present the client with a bill, and he faints on the spot. He is shocked by how many hours you're claiming you actually worked on the case. How do you deal with such cases? So here we have a bit of a problem. The problem is that in halacha, in general, the rule is hamitzim mechaveru alvarai. If you want to make someone pay, you have the burden of proof to establish, really beyond any doubt, that you're actually entitled to those funds. When an attorney presents a client with a bill, he'll say he put 300 hours into the job. The client says, I have no idea. I'm shocked. I didn't expect it to take this long. But what kind of proof do you have? What kind of evidence can you show that will really prove how much time you put into this particular case? Now, you come up with a very professional-looking spreadsheet, but what's that spreadsheet based on? It's based on the data that you entered. So typically, an attorney, or really any professional, has very weak or no evidence that really shows how many hours he put into the case. And therefore, a client, at least under technical halacha, would be able to say, listen, I don't know. Prove to me that you did this work if you want me to shell out that kind of money. Now, although this is, in theory, what the halacha should be, however, we do find there's a takana in a number of cases. Probably the simplest case where it's most similar to is the case of a yoyrid, which is someone goes ahead and he provides a service for you. He has to spend money. One of the cases discussed is actually there was a fellow, he had problems with the government. He was thrown into jail. He needed someone to rescue him. He needed a good attorney to bail him out. The fellow bailed him out, but apparently the way things worked back then, this was many, many hundreds of years ago, please do not try this in practice, but what you had to do is you had to bribe the right people. So at the end of the day, after he provided the service, he went to his client who was now free and said, listen, this is my expense account. I had $5,000 bribe, $5,000 for bribing this official and the entire... The fellow said, let's improve it. I want witnesses that can show who you bribed and how much you spent. Now, quite obviously, no one's going to have... If someone's going to accept a bribe, he's not going to do it in front of two witnesses. So over here we have a concept that a yoyrid is nishba benoito. Any case where you spend money on someone else's say-so, you're instructed to do it, there's an understanding that if I tell you to spend money at the end of the day and you spend it, you can come back to me as long as you make a shvu, as long as you swear, this is the amount I actually spent, I'm going to have to pay, and I can't say, bring witnesses, amoytum echavel varayah. Because I think we can all understand it's part of the bargain. When I tell you to spend it, when I tell you to incur this expense, there's an expectation I'm going to pay you. So although the attorney will not have to bring witnesses, he will not have to bring hard evidence how much time he spent, nevertheless, he does have to make a shvur. He will have to swear, this is the amount of time I put in. I actually spent these hours on your case. And if he's not willing to make a shvur, then this halacha doesn't apply. Because although the client trusts him to the degree that he doesn't need witnesses, he doesn't need something that would qualify as evidence, nevertheless, he's not just giving him a carte blanche or just do what you want. The attorney would have an obligation to make a shvua to back up his claim. Now, in practice today, batei din do not administer an oath. They do not administer a shvua for various reasons. It is very, as Rabbi Gutman mentioned, it's considered very serious in halacha. We are afraid people are not that careful. Normally, there's a concept, bezin makes a pshara. Because you're not making a shvua, the bezin will have the right to knock a few dollars off the bill. In practice, what will generally happen is like this. If the records the attorney provides are very clean, they're very clear, and the bezin sees no reason to doubt it. In that case, the bezin will likely make the person pay the entire amount, because this is how business is done. You hire someone, he works for you, he keeps the records, we rely on him, and there's no other alternative. On the other hand, if the bills start looking suspect, after going through the records, the attorney admits there are a couple of mistakes, and things are not 100% clear, at that point, the bezin will have a very different approach. At that point, because in technical halacha, the attorney wants to get paid, has to make a shavua. If he's not willing to do so, and now his records are suspect, the Beis Din is going to probably knock down the bill significantly. So it's critical that if there is a kind of dispute, you're coming to Beis Din with records, you're making a claim of the amount of time you put in, your records really have to be airtight. And anything which is iffy or questionable, get rid of it before you come into Beis Din, because if you come into Beis Din, you make a claim, and then under cross-examination, facts emerge, which starts making some of it suspect, then that will really color how they look at the entire claim. So it's important to make sure your records are very clear. If you're going to be doing guesstimating, you don't know exactly how much time you spent, you had some phone calls, and you're just going to make up numbers, you have to be very, very careful and very confident that you're being conservative in your estimates.
So not to put into the engagement letter that the client is going to trust what you present as your billing hours?
Yes, that would be helpful. There is a concept in halacha of ne'emanus, that when two parties engage in a transaction, one of them says, I will trust you, or your word will have ne'emanus, mukabel you like shnei edim, that would work. In a case where the Beis Din sees that trust was misplaced, that they see that some of these line items are very iffy, they may ignore that, but it certainly would help, and in the absence of any real red flags, you'll prevail if you have that kind of clause.
What about if your firm uses a software that basically, if you work on it for 2 minutes, it's a 0.1 or a 0.25, so every 2 minutes, not literally 2 minutes, it gets converted into maybe 6 minutes.
So that goes back to the engagement letter or minhug. 2 minutes is not 6 minutes. It's just not the same. You know, consult with the accountants here. Now, if in your letter there's a certain minimum, of, you know, 0.1, you know, everything is billed in a tenth of an hour increments, and therefore the client knows every time he sends an email to the attorney, okay, what time are we scheduled for? Okay, that's 6 minutes because that's how the billing system works. If he accepts it, he accepts it. We can deal with Hilchos Ayna, but if everyone does it, this is standard industry practice, you would be hard to argue it's Ayna because this is what everyone does. On the other hand, if this is not widespread, this is not industry practice, this is the way your particular firm does it, you're going to have a very hard time making that stick unless you disclosed it in advance.
If the dispute is where there's a large upfront retainer and the amount is now whether the hourly matched it or whatever, let's say the hourly now flip and the client now has to disprove the claim because the money of the retainer is in the hands of the lawyer?
Correct. It's always a good idea to take a large retainer. And you can quote me on that. Okay, so this is as far as... So now let's get to perhaps the most relevant or most controversial issue, and that is billing for downtime or double billing. Now let's start with two classic cases. You are working for a client, you have a meeting in which you have to travel to. Obviously, any good attorney is traveling, is charging for his time. He's charging for his travel time as well. Now, while you're in the car on the way home from the meeting, you get a phone call. It's another client. Pick up the phone. You have a half-hour conversation with him, of course, on a Bluetooth, hands-free. So, sure enough, you're going to send him a bill as well. So what's happening is you're charging one client for the travel time. At the same time, you're charging another client for that phone conversation. Mutzer Marase. Similar case, you're in court, waiting for the judge. The judge decides taking a lunch break or just doesn't show up for some reason. You're sitting around for a couple hours in the hallway. You have nothing to do. You have your laptop. You sit down, you get some work done for another client. So on one hand, you want to bill the first client because you sat there, you spent the entire day in court waiting for this judge. That's what you needed to be on call. On the other hand, you use that time to service another client. Let's take this question a step further. If you're going to argue that you cannot double bill, and you're going to take the position that if you have this other client that you're servicing while you're waiting, you can't bill it to the first client, do you have an obligation if you're sitting around waiting in court, or you're driving the car, doing nothing, just wasting your time, you have an obligation, if there are other phone calls to make, pick up the phone and use the time, create other billable hours in order to save the first client that fee? Yes or no? So let's, now, unsurprisingly, this is not discussed explicitly in the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch. However, there are two cases that I'd like to go through. And then after we go through these two cases, let's see how it applies to halacha l'maisa, to our examples. Case number one. You hired a worker. This is a case in the Gemara. It's brought down in Simon Shin Lamed Gimel, Dalet, and Hay, all three of them, actually. The case there will be involved manual labor, but from there we will derive a halacha that will apply to attorneys as well. The case was you hired someone to water your field or to plow your field. The worker showed up. He began working. And for whatever reason it was, halfway through the job couldn't continue. It rained, it flooded. There was no more work to be done. So the halacha is, in many cases, again, this is not always true, but just in many cases, you hire the worker. It was the employer's responsibility to make sure that the job could be done. If he was negligent, if he failed to check it in advance, and now halfway through the job there's nothing else to be done, the employer is liable to pay the worker. What's the halacha if the worker works half the day? There's no work, at this point there's a flood, he can't continue working. On the other hand, the field next door is workable. And your neighbor comes and says, listen, I see you have a worker, he's sitting around, let him work for me and I'll pay him. The worker says, nothing doing. I have a contract with my guy. I showed up. I worked half a day. If he doesn't have work for me, I'm going to sit back. I'm going to relax and bill him. Why should I go ahead and work for you? I don't have anything to do with you. The halacha is, that claim is not a good claim. Because if there's work available, if you're able to, if this person is able to go next door and work the same work, the same rate, he won't suffer any loss. The first employer has the right to say, I'm very sorry for this misunderstanding. I hired you for the whole day and now you're sitting around doing nothing. But the bottom line is, I'm not causing you a loss. Because you can hop next door, you can do the same job, same rate, go there and do that work. And if you don't, if you'd rather take a day off, don't come to me to pay your salary. I haven't caused you any loss, and that is the halacha. Now, based on that, we apply that Gemara to our case. If you're sitting around waiting for the judge, so normally the client has to pay because he came on your behalf. You'd like to be litigating. You'd like to be in front of that judge arguing your case. Can't be done. There's an onus. It's no one's fault, but it simply can't be done. The judge isn't here. Things are delayed. So your client has to pay. But if there's other work available, if there's another client of yours that wants you to work, and let's assume that this work is not it's not taking away from other work that you'll do in the future, but you have the ability to take this downtime and use it productively at the same rate, it would seem, based on this Gemara, that number one, you'd have an obligation to do that, and if you choose not to take the call, you say, listen, I'm very happy sitting here in courtroom. In the courtroom, billing, I'll call my wife, I'll do things that aren't billable, it would seem that the client can say, I'm not paying. I haven't caused you a loss. You have the ability to work at the same rate. This is Gemara number one. Gemara number two, in the beginning of Matziah and Daf Yudalid, discusses a case where you had an employee, or for that matter, a slave, who was working for you. And the Gemara discusses what happens if he picks up, while he's working, he finds something that's lying around on the ground. Then he picks it up. It's a mitzvah. Who is entitled to that thing that he found? So the Gemara says that the Eved, or for that matter, the poyel, the worker is entitled to keep that mitzvah. Now the Gemara says, why? He's working for me. If he finds something and he picks it up, I should be entitled to it. He's my employee. So the Gemara has a number of terusim. But one of the terusim the Gemara says, Magbia Mitzia Imalachta. The case is, he's working. He doesn't have to stop working for you. He doesn't have to stop performing his work in order to pick up the item. So I maintain, while he's doing the job for you, he's able to pick up this item at the same time. And what the Gemara says in that case, if you're paying someone to do a job, and while he's working for you, he's able to, at the same time, find this mitzvah, create value, you're not entitled to that. Because He's performing the service. You're paying him for a service, he's performing that service for you. The fact that on the side, he's able at the same time to get a messiah, that's his windfall, that's his benefit, and the employer or the owner of the slave would have no claim on that money. Now, if we take that to our case, let's analyze the first case we discussed. You hire someone, you're working for a client, he says, I need you to travel, we have a meeting in New Jersey. Your job is to get in the car and spend an hour and a half driving to this meeting. Now, if while you're in the car driving, you're able to, at the same time, perform services for someone else. Is that like the first gemara or the second gemara? So in that case, it's not taking away from your task. You're driving the same speed. It's at the same time, while you're performing the service, while you're driving, you're picking up a mitzvah. You're able to create value. So in that case, if you're hired to travel, and you are traveling, and you happen to be able to do something else at the same time to earn money, that would seem to be like the second gemara, in which case, you would have the right to double bill, because the first person is not losing, you're performing the service that you're hired to do, and this second service doesn't take away in any way, shape, or form. On the other hand, if you're hired to do a job, and in the case of the courtroom where you're sitting around, you aren't hired to sit around to wait in the hallway. You're hired to litigate the case. Now, because of an oinus, you can't perform that job. You're not able to do what you're hired to do. In that case, where you're not performing what you're supposed to be doing, you're an oinus, there the obligation for your client to pay is an obligation because of the damage that was caused. So there, if you're able to mitigate that damage, if you're able to, while you're waiting around the courtroom, do other work at the same billable rates, then arguably the first client should not be responsible. So the difference between these two cases seems to be is that if you're performing the service you're hired to do, and at the same time you're able to create other billable hours, wonderful. That's your gain. That's the equivalent of a mitzvah. On the other hand, if you're not performing the work that you're hired to do, not because it's your fault, but simply because there's an oinus, you're waiting around. So then, to the extent you can mitigate that oinus, and to the extent you can take another job and get paid the same pay, there it would seem from, according to the first Gemara, you would not have the ability to double bill. Now, although this is true in theory, I think in practical halacha, it would be different, really for two reasons. First we'll start with Chumra, and then we'll go with Kula. I guess Chumra and Kula really depends on your perspective. But as far as the actual distinction, you know, in theory, when you hire a worker, you hire someone to paint your house, and now he can't work for a few hours, the halacha is certainly, if he has a way to mitigate that loss, to do other work while he's waiting, he'd have an obligation to do so. And if he doesn't do so, if he does so, he can't send you a bill. He can't double bill the clients. On the other hand, today, when you hire an attorney, I don't think it's fair to say you hired him to litigate in court. When he's sitting around the hallways, that's an oinus, that's downtime. When you hire him, you know good and well in advance, you're hiring him to go to the courtroom and sit there, spend the whole day, do whatever needs to be done for you. And therefore, sitting and waiting around is not an oinus. There was a flood, something unanticipated, something which is broke, now I can't do what I'm hired to do. I think it's all part of the job. When you hire an attorney, you know you're going to be paying him for his litigation time, you're going to be paying him for his preparation, you're also going to be paying for him to sit around. And if that's true, sitting around is the same as traveling, I'm paying him to sit and wait, and therefore the fact that he can create value at the same time, that's his benefit, and therefore as a man of halakha, he should be able to double bill for such cases. Now, although I believe this would be the halakha going based on the strict principles of Chesh Mishpat, nevertheless, the American Bar Association, they have a formal opinion, 93-379, in which they clarified Model Rule 1.5. They specifically addressed these cases. Apparently, Model Rule number 1.5 about fees, one of the requirements is the fees be reasonable. And this formal opinion clarified what reasonable is. Apparently, they did not trust attorneys to be good judges or what the definition of what is reasonable and what is not. And they made the point that charging four clients for the same time is not reasonable. At the end of the end, there are just so many hours in the day, and therefore, if you're traveling to a courtroom representing four clients, it's unfair to say I'm billing four people for that same travel time, And based on this on this formal opinion, an attorney cannot double bill. He has to either prorate, but he cannot bill multiple clients for this for the same time. Now, when you have such a formal rule and you have such an opinion, that would be binding in halacha really because of two approaches. The first is the concept of minhag. Whenever you have in chesh mishpat a standard business practice, so the minhag will govern the party's expectations. To the extent that this is the way business is done, when you do business, unless you stipulate otherwise, the assumption is you're agreeing to follow the norms and the standards of the industry. So when you have the bar association setting down rules, this is what appropriate billing is. This is what it isn't. Arguably, that creates the minhag ha'sekrim. That creates an industry norm, and therefore, as a matter of halacha, that would be binding as well, even if that norm is not the same as a default in chesh mishpat. Now, of course, what's open to debate, and I'll perhaps leave this as an open question, is what would be if the reason why you're bound to this is minhag. This is the industry standard. What are the facts on the ground? What is the industry standard? What is done when an attorney is traveling and at the same time he makes a phone call for another client? Is the practice to double bill or not? Because if the practice is to double bill, we have a fascinating question. We have a halacha which, in the absence of any agreement, would perhaps allow it. We have this formal rule that says it can't be done. And that creates minhag, which creates the norm which everyone's bound to. But if that norm is widely ignored and it's not followed, does that really create a minhag? Arguably not. A minhag means this is how business is done. If it's not the way business is done, then you cannot argue that there's a minhag which should be a vat halacha, which should override the default in chesh mishpat. And that being said, in this case, you're probably stuck regardless, because even if there's no minhag, even if it's not the widespread practice, if at the end of the day the Bar Association says, these are the rules, you want to practice law, you want to be admitted to the bar, you've got to follow these guidelines. So certainly a client expects you and is hiring a licensed attorney, has the right to demand you follow the rules that are required to maintain your license. And therefore, if you're going to engage in billing practices that violate these rules, that are not consistent with their standards, even in the absence of minhag, they'd have the right to hold you to it. And therefore, at the end of the day, you will not be able to double bill.